All right, good morning. You'll notice as Jared prayed there, a lot of our young people are out in Germany right now, and so we'll have an update from them a little bit later in our service, but keep praying for them as they're over there, many of them first-time travelers overseas and being used by God over in Germany. So welcome this morning if you're new with us. My name is Chris. I'm one of the pastors here at Parkside. We are journeying our way through the Psalms. And so what we do normally as a practice is we just kind of take a book of the Bible and just go verse by verse by verse, let God speak and set the agenda. What we do during the summertime, because people are in and out, visiting, going on vacations, etc., we kind of grab select Psalms. And so every summer we're just kind of working our way to eventually we'll cover every Psalm that's in here, all 150. So last week we looked at Psalm 42. We talked about depression last week, and so this week is going to be very different. We're looking at Psalm 42 from last week. We're Psalm 19, as was read, and I'll do the first part this morning, and then next Sunday we'll finish up Psalm 19 and have two parts to it. So the title is The Great Communicator, Psalm 19, 1 through 6. Let me pray for us, and then we'll get started. Father, help us, Lord, as we study your word, as we examine really what your word has to say about the world, and God, what you have made out there in the world, and so including even us. And so, Lord, I pray that you would give us a new appreciation, a new delight and joy in your created world, and God, we would use that as a means of both joy in our own souls, as a means of understanding you and who you are, and God, of making you known. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, God is the inventor of communication. One of the first things we learn in the Bible is that God communicates. He's a speaking God, right? You open up the very beginning of the Bible, you start reading in the beginning, you know, God, and then say the first thing God did is God did what? He said, right? He spoke. He communicated. It's one of the first actions we find of God in the Bible. And that's how everything got started. That's how all the world, universe, us, everything got its beginning. In C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia series, there's a segment of that book that I really enjoy the way he kind of worded it. In that book, Aslan, who's kind of the Christ figure, they spoke about how Narnia got started. And in the story, they talk about Aslan, the lion, started singing. And he started singing, and that's how universes began to pop out, right? He talks about as he sang, out popped universes and galaxies and planets and stars and mountains and hills began to kind of unroll as he sang it into existence. And so as we look at the Bible and look at our world, we realize that Jesus literally has like galaxies dripping from his fingertips, right? I mean, he just spoke it all into existence and it came. And this means primarily that God then is not... God is not just an idea, okay, to be thought about. It's not an idea to be thought about, but rather God desires to communicate to us, which means God is a person, all right? We know that from the Bible as well. He's not an idea. He is a person to be related to, a person to be known, a person to be loved and listened to and obeyed. He's a person who creates and communicates. And the Bible then becomes God's continued communication to us. He speaks to us on every single page of the Bible, communicating the story of salvation, communicating the story of himself, communicating even the story about us. God loves to communicate. He loves to tell stories. He loves to do that. You just read the Gospels and you'll see Jesus telling stories, right? He'll be talking over and over again about things, such stories as there was a man who had two sons. There was a rich man who had a manager, a nobleman who went into a far country, a man planted a vineyard, and Jesus would go on and on and on telling stories to us to help us understand truths. And so the Bible is full of story, the communication of God. This led A.W. Tozer to say the following. He said this, God is not silent. It's the nature of God to speak. The second person of the Holy Trinity is called the Word. The Bible is the inevitable outcome of God's continuous speech. And so when we talk about this communication of God, there's a word we use in theology, a word we throw around there. It's called the word revelation. And it's really a synonym for communication, right? It's God's revealing, unveiling of himself. The word revelation literally means to make plain, to unfold that which has been hidden before, make it known. And thus, in revelation, God is revealing himself to us in different forms, making himself known in ways previously unknown. And so as we think about that God has two distinct ways he communicates to us. And this is what we talk about in theology. It's this. It's God communicates in what we call general revelation, and how God communicates in what's called special revelation. How God communicates in his creation and how God communicates through the Bible, right? How God communicates, Spurgeon called it the world book and the word book, right? The Jonathan Edwards called it God's second book over here in creation, God's first book, the Bible. These are God's ways of communicating to us to help us understand who he is. And Psalm 19 lines up perfectly with this. Psalm 19 is literally the revelation of God. In one, the first part we read this morning, we'll look at today, is God's revelation of himself in creation. All right, the second half of the psalm, you can read on there, starting in verse 7, is God's revelation of himself in the Bible. Okay, so that's what we're going to look at. This Sunday, we'll look at God's revelation of himself in creation, and next Sunday in the Bible. This Sunday is like show and tell, all right? I'm going to have a lot of pictures for you. You'll really enjoy it, okay? A lot of pictures, a lot of things we're going to look at, because we're going to talk about general revelation. We're going to talk about creation. I can't do that without showing you some pictures, so it'll be fun. It'll be like being in second grade. It'll be fun. All right, so in that, we'll be looking at these two different, really, knowledges of God. John Calvin, a theologian back in the 16th century, said he called it he had a Latin word for it, duplex cognitio. The word means literally the twofold knowledge of God. Knowledge of God in creation, knowledge of God in the Bible, okay? And so God is speaking to us through the created world. Are you listening to him? Are you listening? Are your eyes open to see the fingerprints of God all around you? Are you reading a story through the created world? There is much joy to be derived, much knowledge to be treasured, a God to be worshipped through what we can see in the created world. And so we'll see this morning, we'll see five things here about God's communication. He's a powerful communicator, a restless communicator, a silent communicator, a universal communicator, and a loving communicator. Number one, the powerful communicator. Verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky proclaims the work of his hands. The word declare is a very strong word. It's used in another part of the Psalms to give us a good picture. It's used in Psalm 78:4 as a reference to parents telling their kids about the realities of God, okay? And they're supposed to rehearse and tell them about the times that they were in Egypt and what all God did back then. And so it's the same word. They are to proclaim or declare to their kids. If you're a parent who loves Jesus, right, you're not like to your kids going, well, I'll just let them figure out Jesus someday, right? Or I'll just let their friends tell them about him. I don't know. If you love Jesus and you love your kids, Lord willing, you're actually looking at them going, no, I'm going to tell them myself. I'm going to proclaim it to them. It's a very passionate, heart-driven thing, right? You're very passionate about, I want my kids to know Jesus. I want them to know the reality of God, so I'm going to tell it to them. That's the word that's used here. It's a very passionate proclamation. You aren't passive. You want to make sure that they know. You have friends. You want to make sure that they know the reality of God. I remember back in Los Angeles, where we were kind of originally from, my kids kind of grew up there, and Sadie, when she was in kindergarten in L.A., one day she had a couple friends over for like a play date, you know, after school, and they came over, and at that time, we'd been going through the Jesus Storybook Bible. If you know what that is, there's some in the bookstore. If you're a parent with little kids, highly recommended. Best one out there. It's phenomenal. We went through 3 volumes of it, like literally the binding came off. My kids just were learning this Jesus Storybook Bible. We just read it over and over and over again. And so she had her friends over, you know, and she was in school there, and most of her friends didn't even know the reality of God at all, right? And so they had really no idea who Jesus was. So they came over, they were out there playing in the backyard, and Sadie comes running in, hey, where's the Jesus Storybook Bible? Where's the Jesus Storybook Bible? I'm like, here it is. You know, she runs outside, she takes it, and of course me and Sarah kind of peek through the windows to watch what's about to happen, you know? And so they all kind of gather around the picnic table, and she brings them all over, and they're all with, you know, with popsicle sticks, and they're all like looking, she's flipping through the pages, and you can see her pointing at stuff, you know? And then she gets to the page where Jesus is on the cross, and one of the kids starts to laugh at the picture. They had no concept of who Jesus is or dying on the cross. They laugh because like, he looks really funny, he's all beat up, you know, kind of thing. And the other kids start laughing, and Sadie, in her kindergarten voice, and I'll do the best I can with this one, because it was so cute. You could hear her through the window. She said, that's not funny. That's not funny. Jesus died for your sins. Jesus died for your sins. That's not funny. Don't laugh at him, you know? And so she was proclaiming to him, right? She was like telling all her friends, like, no, you need to understand the reality of God. And that is what the word is that God is doing with this creation. He is telling us, proclaiming to us the reality of God. He's dropping that kind of knowledge on us. And so he declares, he shouts, he preaches, as it were. And the other word here used is the word proclaim, which is, again, where we get our word revelation from. It means to reveal, to make known. So God is revealing himself to us, showing us things about himself. We need to look up, as the psalm tells us. Look to the sky, the universe. See his declaration. See his fingerprints all over the creation. The sky, the universe, is like think about it, like an endless looping film. Right? It's an endless looping film that's continually displaying the glory of God, right? Whether it be through sunsets, whether it be through sunrises, whether it be through the universe out in the stars. I was looking up the Hubble telescope and kind of just checking out. I'd tell you, it's fascinating. Just go in and just look at all the images that this telescope has captured of the depths of the universe out there. And so it says in the psalm that this universe that we're looking at on the screen is displaying the glory of God. It's God's summary of all that God is. You say, God, what's God's glory? God's glory is like your license, right? Like my license says, 5'11", 185, brown eyes, and, in decreasingly amount of brown hair. Something like that, right? That's what it should say. It doesn't say that part, but it should. But it's like, that's my attributes, right? That's kind of describing a little bit about me. Well, this is God describing about himself. He's proclaiming to us. One writer said that the word glory is that asset which makes people and individuals or objects impressive. I love that. So the universe is proclaiming to us, hey, God's impressive. He's impressive. Look at us. He's impressive. He's remarkable. That's what he's talking about. He's extraordinary, right? Extraordinary. So that is the story we read in the sky as we look up. The stars, the moon, the sun are yelling out that God is impressive. And here's an interesting part too. The message that comes back from observing all of the universe and the creation is what comes back is not that we're impressive, right? That's not what comes back as you look. It's not that, oh, we're so impressive. No, it's something else is really, really, really impressive. And the funny thing about that as we observe it is actually we're a little bit okay with that, okay? We're okay with the fact that we're not impressed by looking at this grand creation. Because no matter what your belief is, or no matter what your creeds are, there's something wonderful about feeling small in the presence of greatness. We like seeing something beyond us and kind of losing a sense of self at times. It's a place where we can look and where all that is weighing us down, all that is heavy and burdens on our soul, kind of gets lost for a moment, right? You ever had those moments where you kind of just, you see something great out in creation, you see the universe, see the star, you see a sunset, and just at least for a few seconds, you kind of forget you exist, right? For a few seconds, you forget all of that trouble and all the anxiety and all the weight and just kind of goes away. Why is that? We like that because we're caught into something great. Right, we're caught into that. This is, we talked about last week, the depression, some of the ways to help work through that. This is one of those practical ways, is to observe the creation and just lose your sense of self for a little bit and all the problems of life in that way. It's a great anecdote to fight depression, as we talked about last week. This led John Piper to say the following. He says, we're all starved for the glory of God, not self. No one goes to the Grand Canyon to increase self-esteem. Why do we go? Because there is greater healing for the soul in beholding splendor than there is in beholding self. Indeed, what could be more ludicrous in a vast and glorious universe like this than a human being on the speck called Earth standing in front of a mirror trying to find significance in his own self-image? We even feel this as a culture. Forget creation for a minute. We even when we just make it up, right? Even when we just put it into a film, and we use all our technology to kind of create beautiful images on a film, we even get lost into that. Some years ago, I remember I was back in L.A. when the movie Avatar came out, and it broke all the box office hits, right? And it was the highest grossing film of all time. The most fascinating thing after that came out was I saw an article that came out that was describing an increased spike in patients going to see doctors because of depression. And thousands of doctors were reporting that we have this increased amount of depression happening from people watching this film. You're like, why? What is the connection? Here's the connection. They got into this film. They saw something of another world. They saw beauty. They saw sounds and things they'd never seen before. And they walk out of that dark room, and they're kind of lost in that film, and they walk out back to their, you know, they go back to their cubicle, right? They go back to the office. They go back to the basement or whatever, and they go back to the reality of life, and all the burdens and all the things come back on them, and they kind of get depressed, like, oh, this is, I got to go back to real life. Like, I want to live in that, you know, the Avatar world. You know, it's like that. I want to live some part that's like beautiful like that. And that's what's happening to us. We're actually longing for that other world. My friends, there's an endless looping film of wonder and beauty and color and sound and splendor right above you. It is screaming out that Jesus is impressive, that he is remarkable. He's so much better, right? So lift your head up, you know, look out. He's so much better than a mirror, okay? He's so much better than you know, selfies and Instagram photos and all of that stuff, right? He's better than all of that. Look up, look out, and see what it's saying about the glory of God. Number two, the restless communicator. Verse 2 says, day after day they pour out speech, night after night they communicate knowledge. Do you realize that God has a restless desire? I like that adjective. It's a restless desire to communicate to us. Restless. The term day after day and night after night are a reference to God's restless communication. There is not a single day or night that goes by without God communicating. Think about this. Even while we sleep, God doesn't turn the communication off when you go to sleep, by the way. You aren't the center of the universe, just in case you didn't know that, right? It keeps going, right? Even you go to sleep, God continues to, the film just keeps rolling. It just keeps communicating. And this recurring pattern of day and night, instead of merely slipping by, become like an endless song. Just an endless song, just singing, singing, singing. And so God's communication to us never stops. It doesn't turn off, on or off. It doesn't even have an off switch, right? His declaration of himself, he never goes to sleep. It's not intermittent. You know what intermittent means? I worked in, put myself through seminary. Most people don't know this. I don't make this known because then I'll have requests for this, but I'll say it now. When I was in seminary, I put my way through seminary working in the field of audiology. I worked on hearing aids. You're like, I could use some help. I probably help you a little bit. But I worked in audiology, and my field was a technician, which sounds glorious. You're like, oh, you're a technician of audiology. That sounds so professional. It wasn't, because what I did is I fixed broken hearing aids. And usually there was two problems almost always. Number one, earwax was always the number one problem. That, yes, it just gets in the hearing aid and you got to clean it out, right? It's just kind of the way it works. And the second part was what we called intermittent problems, which was the most frustrating for all my patients, right? Because you'll be in a conversation, you'll be talking, the hearing aid's working great, and all of a sudden they go off. You're like, oh, I missed the last part of that, what you just said. Can you say it again? Then it comes back on. And you're like, oh, it's too loud. I got to turn it down. And it's just constant. And then people just take them out. And they're like, forget them. Because it goes in and out and in and out and in and out. What we're saying here with God is that his communication doesn't go in and out. It doesn't turn on and turn off. And it's high, too low. It is always going nonstop, right? Just keeps going. Notice the word also. I love the word here in this language, the word pour out. The word pour out is the idea of a powerful stream of water, okay? The other day, this week, we had a storm come through, right? And in the storm that came through, I thought for a second that Jesus might be coming back because the clouds were covered. You know, he says he's coming back in the clouds, so I figured it's going to be like eclipse time because, you know, the clouds are going to cover the sun. That's kind of my own imagination of that. But it does say he's coming back with the clouds. So I'm like, it gets dark in my office in here. I mean, literally, it's like an eclipse at midday. I'm like, what is going on? You hear the thunder. And so I walk out, like, basically with a flashlight because I can't see because I have my lights turned down because I like the natural light. And I'm like walking out into the office, and the gals are out there, and we're looking. And I look out the window. It's like rain going sideways. Remember this day, right? It's just like, it's like a hurricane out there. And it's pouring so hard on top of the roof of the church here that the gutters can't keep up with it. It's just kind of just, in every few seconds, it just flows over top. It's like you're under Niagara Falls. Okay, did you experience this, like at your house with this? That's the language. The language is that God is it's like a torrential downfall of communication. A torrential downfall of communication is coming to us out in the creation. This tells us a few things about creation, right? It tells us, first of all, that every single part of nature testifies to its creator, so that whatever part you happen to be looking at, it will drench you with knowledge. Also, this means it's impossible to miss it. You don't have to have a PhD in science to pick up the communication. Even a child can hear this communication. Matter of fact, it can be argued that children probably hear it better than we do, right? They see the glory of God better than we do. We had some visitors, some friends of ours visiting here from Austin, Texas last week, and they have three little boys, and one of them is just like 1 year old. And I tell you what, they put this one-year-old in the room playing with Dodger, my dog, Dodger the dog. I am a Dodger fan, by the way. I did name my dog Dodger for that very reason. It's better, like, if you're a Cubs fan, like, what are you going to name your dog Cub, right? So, see, I got a good idea, Dodger. So we call him Dodger, and this little boy's in there, this little one-year-old, and he is just fascinated with this puppy, right? I mean, he's just, like, playing around with the dogs, like, playing with him. It was the cutest thing to kind of behold and watch them kind of play together. And, you know, for us, it's like, we've had Dodger for 8 months. We're like, yeah, he's a dog. You know, the shine kind of wears off. You know, like the new car you get, and you're like, yeah, it's a car now. It was cool at first, and now it's like, I mean, we love Dodger. But it was something about this baby looking and seeing this dog with eyes we hadn't seen before. And that's the idea. They just delight in it. They see it. But let's say that let's also say that if you do have the privilege of having a degree in science or something, or the opportunity to study or analyze creation, you'll find the testimony of nature even stronger in a way as you get to look beneath the surface, right? The more one looks, the more the heavens gush forth knowledge. So what kind of knowledge is creation dropping on us? What kind of knowledge is creation telling us about God? Let me give you a few. Number one, it's telling us of God's existence, okay? God's existence. Romans 1:20 says, for his invisible attributes, that is, his eternal power and divine nature, okay, his existence, have been clearly seen since the creation of the world. So the creation of the world made it visible. The creation of the world made the existence of God known. And so we find out that the Bible is not necessary for knowing that God exists. And we'll talk about it next week. It's necessary for salvation, but it's not necessary for knowing that at the bare minimum that God does exist. Look to the skies to see evidence of an infinite power, wisdom, and even beauty of God. It's to observe a majestic witness to the fact that God is real. Number two, as we just talked about earlier, it reveals to us the glory of God. Isaiah 6:3 says, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of armies. His glory fills the whole earth. It saturates. It just fills the whole thing up. Again, the world is proclaiming, hey, God is impressive. And so we see his value, his worth, his signature over all of creation. It's gushing forth this truth. Just look at, I was looking this week, some of our show and tell time, some of the creatures that, just the creatures they discovered this year. I always love looking at this, like the latest year, like, okay, what have they found this year? What are these creatures that God has been marveling at for like, you know, forever since creation, has been marveling at it, and we're just now finding it, right? We're just now noticing it exists. Here's a few of them. One is this rose-tinted catadid, I guess is how you say it. Katydid. Thank you. See, you guys know more than I do. I don't know any of this stuff. I just look at the pictures like, whoa, this is cool, whatever it's called. But this is pretty cool. All right, so it looks like a leaf. Another one that they found, this is the water bear. Now, they found water bears before. They've been for a few hundred years. This is not made up. This is like really, really serious. But they discovered a new one in a Japan parking lot, actually. They found this. It's less than like 0.1 millimeter size. So this thing's tiny, you know, this little water bear guy. Another one that they found was the Pink Floyd pistol shrimp. That's what they call it, the Pink Floyd pistol shrimp. He's got like, you know, his pink pistol there on the side, I guess. He's ready to shoot. And then check out these. So here's some other creatures that I found. These are just how they blend into their environment, how God even created them and made them. Maybe you can notice them there. The eastern screech owl, you'll see that guy. You can probably observe him there inside the tree. The conehead mantis. It kind of reminds me of Groot, if you guys are familiar with Groot. Doesn't it? It's like Hollywood ripped off God's creation, right? There's Groot there. It looks like he's like ready to, you know, he's ready to fight. The candy crab, because I guess he looks like peppermint, is kind of why they call him that, the candy crab. And this is a nice picture of the Arctic fox, all right? The one is just beautiful, just blends into its environment in that way. And lastly, the Turaco, I think is how you say that. Just reminded me of my son's hair, so that's why I put him up there. It's like caveman's hair. Anyway, but it just, I mean, these are all, I mean, they're just, you can just look, just go to the zoo, like go outside, observe and see. I mean, just go to the internet and search it. I mean, there is just so much glory to be seen, so much value to be seen of God in his created world. So creative. Number three, God's wisdom. We see God's wisdom out there in the world. Psalm 104:24 says, "How countless are your works, Lord. In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures." So if you read all of Psalm 104, it's going to tell us about how God was wise and how he made boundaries for the oceans, right? It talks about the sea level and such. How he made food for animals to eat, how he gave them the ability to sleep and the ability to make homes for themselves, how he set times of day for morning and night to kind of set the rhythm of life. Like, yeah, just very wise in how he created the world and how it runs. And so the universe really becomes a masterpiece of God's wisdom. A torrential downfall of order. Just think about the human body for a moment. Let's consider a few parts of that. Consider the eye for a moment. There are, and this is, trust me, I looked this up, okay? I don't just know this information, but Google can be really helpful. All right, there are 10 million electrical connections on the eye that can handle 1.5 million simultaneous messages. Goes on to talk about when light hits your retina, the message travels to the brain at an impressive 268 miles per hour. This is faster than a Formula One race car over the Indianapolis 500, which tops out about 240 miles an hour. So it's traveling faster. If you've been to the racetrack and watched it zoom, 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 it's going faster than that, the information is. An image is formed in the brain in as little as 13 milliseconds, which is less time than it takes you to even blink your eye. All right, it's just information, it's just traveling, shooting through the eye. Then consider the brain for a moment. I was going to put a real brain up there, but then I realized it probably grossed some of you out, so I didn't do that, so we'll just go with this route. The human brain is the world's most complex living structure. Each of its 86 billion nerve cells, neurons, are connected to billions of other nerve cells. These neurons are connected by trillions of synapses. And each neuron can transmit 1,000 nerve impulses per second and make as many as tens of thousands of synaptic contacts with other neurons. A simple message can take billions of different connections and pathways through your brain. And what's even more fascinating, this is the most fascinating part, you could take a piece of brain tissue the size of a grain of sand, and it will contain 100,000 neurons and a billion synapses all communicating with each other. Just a little grain of sand is doing all of that. I mean, just go to the beach and just pick up a little grain of sand and go, wow. I mean, that just that little piece of my brain is doing that much activity, right? I mean, it's just amazing what the wisdom and how God connected and made all of these things. This led Thomas Taylor, he was a Puritan, he didn't even know a lot of these details that we know today. He said this, "The world is God's book. No page is empty, but full of lines. Every quality of the creature is a several letter of this book, and no letter without a part of God's wisdom in it." Just communicating the wisdom of God in creation. Number four, God's power. Isaiah 40, verse 26 says, "Look up and see." I love that. It's a great command. Just take that one. Just look up and see. Who created these? He brings out the stars by number. He calls them all by name. Because of his great power and strength, not one of them is missing. To kind of put God's perspective, power into perspective, consider the tallest and heaviest structure to ever be moved by man. We're not talking about the heaviest structural, no. Let's just talk about the biggest one to ever be moved. It's called the Troll A platform, which is an offshore drilling station located off the shoreline of Norway. It's a huge structure. It doesn't look impressive from the top of the water, but when you consider how far down it goes, you realize that it's taller than most of the biggest, largest buildings in the world is how big it is. If you take that, it's estimated to weigh about 1.2 million tons, which I did the math, is about the weight of a million sedans, okay? Take a million sedans, pile them up, it's about the weight of this one building. It would take over 6 million of these platforms to even come close to beginning to weigh what the Earth itself weighs. They consider that it would take 1.3 million Earths to weigh, and similar to our sun. Then consider it would take 21 billion of our suns to weigh in similar to the black hole in galaxy NGC 4889. I don't expect you to write that down, but I just found it this week. It is called the current heavyweight champion of the universe. Okay, it's the largest, biggest, heaviest thing out there right now that we've discovered. 21 billion of our suns could fit inside of it. I mean, it's just the numbers are just startling, right? Just how large and big. And yet, considering all of that stuff out in the universe, all those things are just being, they're just kind of like hung up there. God's just suspending it, holding it all together, everything that's out there. And all of it, he just said, let it be, and then out it came. Number five, God's beauty. Psalm 8, 3 and 9 says, when I observe your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon, the stars, which you set in place, how magnificent is your name throughout all of the earth. This is a psalmist just reflecting on the glory of God out there in the universe, seeing the beauty of God. And so the natural world points indelibly to the image from which it is made. Again, John Calvin, I love how he put it. So many times we think about these guys like Calvin and Luther and Edwards and all these guys, we automatically gravitate towards maybe areas of systematic theology, which they wrote a lot about. But we fail to realize that what they wrote the most about was actually this subject. There's more written from these guys about God's beauty in the world, God's glory in the creation than any other part, any other subject. And he talked about a lot about the world. He talked about the world as a theater for the contemplation of divine beauty. And he said God was like the central actor. He was the one on central stage, and we're all in the audience observing this play, as it were, going on. He put it this way. He says, we have been placed here as in a spacious theater to behold the works of God. There is no work of God so small that we ought to pass by it lightly, but all ought to be carefully and diligently observed. Every human being is formed to be a spectator of the created world, given eyes that they might be led to its author by contemplating so beautiful a representation. They all did this. I'll give you another one. Jonathan Edwards wrote a lot about the physical world. He talked about how it never ceased to operate for him as he called it a school of desire. Like it, remember we talked about last week, he was one of the guys who brought up it struggled with depression. And he called it a school of desire because it would have a way of awakening in him, kind of removing the clouds and giving him some kind of like just a breath of fresh air and kind of just opened up his eyes to see again the glory of God. And it was funny, he had practices, and I've read quite a few of Edwards' biographies, and he would get on his horse, you know, this is back in the 1700s, right? So he didn't have a car. Just in case you didn't know that. So he would get on, I don't know why I said that. Hopefully you knew that. But he got 1700s, he gets on his horse, and he would go riding through the woods, right? And he would take with him, like, these pins, almost like safety pin type things, and would have, like, his quill and stuff. And he would be walking around. He's riding through the woods and all over the place. He would just scribble down ideas and notes, and he would write, and he'd pin them to his shirt and jacket. And his wife, Sarah Edwards, said in her biography, when he came home, it was like he was just littered with, like, notes he attached to his whole entire body. And then he would ask her to take them off one by one because they had a certain order to them of thought as he was thinking about God out in the world. And so she would take them off and collect them. It's no wonder, by the way, there's a book entitled by Sarah Edwards. The title of the book is called Marriage to a Difficult Man. It's not shocking that's what it's called. Nonetheless, I mean, he would write out through creation, just kind of just take notes. And he would just write it down. I mean, you go out, take notes. What you see, take pictures. You know, use your phone for those purposes. It's good. The Puritans, let me give you another example of this. The Puritans. Now, this is going to be shocking. You probably don't know this if you haven't read much of the Puritans. Most people have a certain, matter of fact, we have a word, right? We call it, you know, puritanical or prude. All those words kind of come from the idea, the root of a Puritan. And we have completely lost our idea of what actually Puritans were and what they were about. And the Puritans were obsessed with two things. I bet you can't guess what these two are. So the Puritans were obsessed with two things. Number one was the countryside, okay? They were obsessed with the countryside. They loved creation. Matter of fact, they created laws and rules. You say, why did they create all these laws and rules? To keep them from any of their people becoming what they call pantheists. Right? Pantheist is someone who believes basically, you know, God is the tree. You know, hug the tree, I'm hugging God type of thing. And so they have all these rules to keep that from happening because they were so obsessed with seeing God in creation. The second thing they were obsessed with was sex. Which you may be like, Puritans? Like, what? Yeah, they created lots of rules around that so that they could actually save the sanctity of that for marriage, right? It was a delightful thing to them. That's why they had all the rules that they did. They were constantly trying to keep those things in place. And so they were bold in defending the glory of God in creation and the sanctity of sexual pleasure in marriage. This is why they created all the rules that they did. And so they talked about making a ladder out of earthly pleasures and materials to ascend to God. And one of them, John Flavel, put it this way. He said, we are to make a ladder out of earthly materials using matter, even cattle and cornfields, to ascend to God. What is he talking about? Using cattle and cornfields. It's observing and looking and seeing the details, right? We have cattle and cornfields around here, right? So you look at them, look closely, observe and see the glory of God displayed through those things. We're going to take all of life and trace it back to its author. We're going to enjoy all things while looking along those things to God. I've mentioned this to you before. I've preached on this quite a few times, but C.S. Lewis called this the doctrine of transposition. Fascinating work. He had a whole article on this, a whole book on this stuff. But he would argue that most Christians have become nothing more than animals in how they look at the world. And here's this kind of illustration he would use. He would say, you could take a dog, and you could take the dog and go like, look over there. You know, you can point to whatever's over there, and what is the dog going to do? He's going to go up and he's going to sniff your finger, right? He's going to lick your finger because he doesn't look anywhere other than what is right in front of him, right? Oh, he sees a finger as a finger. He doesn't see what it's pointing to. He says most Christians have become just obsessed with just the finger of God and not looking at what it's pointing to, just looking at the creation, the cornfield, as like, this is just a cornfield. Not looking at what it points to is what he would argue. And so he said this. He said, a finger is a finger to them, and that's all, to a dog, he said. Their world is all facts with no meaning. No meaning. We should see the facts, but see the meaning behind the facts. See the author behind the creation itself, and not just look at it as like, oh, it's a sunset. Oh, it's a sunrise. Oh, it's an animal. Oh, it's a bird. Okay. No, we should see its author behind it. John Piper put it this way, kind of similar thought. He said, all of God's creation becomes a beam to be kind of looked along, like a sunbeam, or a sound to be heard along, or a fragrance to be smelled along, or a flavor to be tasted along, or a touch to be felt along. Like it's connected to something. All our senses become partners with the eyes of the heart in perceiving the glory of God through the physical world. I'll tell you what, if you get that, I mean, it's a whole enhancement to your spiritual walk, to your walk with God, as you can walk out into creation and start tracing it along, right? And start, look, what does this tell me about God? I've told you this story before. I did it with my kids. When I was first learning this and I first read C.S. Lewis on that transposition stuff, I was like, oh, this is fascinating. Kids, let's go to the zoo. So I took them all to the zoo, you know, and we're walking around. And I'm like, you see that elephant right there? You know, that's like, you know, big he is and strong. You hear him walk. Like, that's like the power of God, you know? And you see the peacock. And you're like, look at the beauty of its feathers. It's like the beauty of God. You know, and we're kind of just walking through each animal, you know, and of course the kids being kids, you know, are like, you see this like, half zebra, half donkey thing. I don't know what it's called, but zonkey, I don't know what it is, but you know, something like that. And you know, you kind of look at some creature like a hyena and they're like, what does that tell us about God? And I'm like, I don't know, but it does tell us what sin looks like, right? I mean, there is still something to learn from that ugly creature, right? This is how bad sin is. You don't want to sin. Okay, so anyway, there's something to be learned about God through all of creation. Number three, the silent communicator. Now this is interesting. Verse three. The silent communicator. There is no speech, no words. Their voice is not heard. Isn't that interesting? We've just talked about this whole time. God's communicating, God's declaring, God's revealing, God's speaking. And here we find there is no speech, voice, or words. What is David, the author, getting at? Isn't that a contradiction? Like, what's happening? He is saying that the creation speaks to us without having to say a single word. It speaks the language of sight to the ear of reason. Bottom line is you're not going to hear an audible voice of God coming from a star or tree or an ant. But their silence is deafening, right? There's an old hymn called The Spacious Firmament on High. It had these lines. I saw this one paragraph said this. In reason's ear they all rejoice and utter forth a glorious voice. Forever singing as they shine, the hand that made us is divine. Right? The hand that made us is divine. It's speaking without ever having to say a word. And so the deafening voiceless testimony is something we have all experienced. Standing with a crowd at the precipice of a Grand Canyon, lying on the ground of a cloudless night, seeing the Milky Way in full display with others, or standing before a great piece of art surrounded by other visitors at an art museum. All of that is the same experience. It's silence. Unless, of course, you're camping out with elementary kids or something to look at the stars. But in most cases, right, it's just silence, right? When you stand before something beautiful, when you're captivated by something and other people around you, you all experience the same thing. You just kind of get quiet. You just kind of get quiet. The silence speaks volumes. The world becomes God's nonverbal communication that he is real. that the world is not an accidental collection of molecules, but rather the meaningful and deliberate work of an artist's hands. A meaningful and deliberate work of an artist's hands. Creation is a masterpiece that speaks to us without words. Think about that. And just think about the reality of it for a minute. Just pull away the theology for a minute and just think about the fact that it's just like gases and liquids and molecules and particles. It's all it is in its physical form. Why does that move us? Why does that move us so much? Because it sings to us that we in all of creation are not an accident. That we in all of creation are the product of artistic vision and design and imagination. And there is wonder and there is depth in all of that silence. It's not, then, as Shakespeare said through his play Macbeth. Macbeth said the following in Shakespeare's novel, "Life is nothing more than an illusion. It's like a poor actor who struts and worries for his hour on the stage and then is never heard from again. Life is a story told by an idiot, full of noise and emotional disturbance, but devoid of meaning." It's not the case. It is brilliant. And it draws us in, and it gets our attention. It awakens in us a reality that is beyond us, an awakening that seems to happen in certain moments of life, right? We catch glimpses of it. There's moments where it's almost as if you can hear creation telling you something, right? I'm not saying I'm listening to cornfields talking to me right now, but I'm just saying, like, there's moments, though, right? You see Chris out there in the cornfield just walking. They said if you build it, they will come. No, that's a bad joke. No, but seriously, like, it's speaking, but there's moments where you almost hear that, right? I mean, I remember sitting in the lake in Minnesota and sitting there and watching all this creation go by, and just, it was just like, it was just so quiet, and yet watching everything move, it was like God was speaking, right? There's moments of life where you just feel that. Again, C.S. Lewis, he put it this way. He says, "For a few minutes, we've had the illusion of belonging to that world. Now we wake to find that it's no such thing. We have been mere spectators. Beauty has smiled, but not to welcome us. Her face has turned our direction, but not to see us. We have not been accepted, welcomed, or taken into the dance. It's not the physical objects that I'm speaking of, but that indescribable something of which they become for a moment the messengers. The part of the bitterness which mixes with the sweetness of that message is due to the fact that it so seldom seems to be a message intended for us, rather something we just overheard. We have the sense that in the universe, we're treated as strangers. We have the longing to be acknowledged, to meet with some response, to bridge some chasm that's between us and reality, and it's all part of what Lewis called the inconsolable secret. There's something in there. As we look and observe in those moments, we see there's something beyond the physical reality of what's in front of me. It's saying something else than just nothing, right? The silence speaks. And then to deny that truth, to say that all creation around us really means nothing, like Macbeth did, is to embrace the only other alternative. There is only one alternative, right? That is that we are the product of accidental natural forces. This means, think about that now, if you hold to that, think about what that means. That means that what you call beauty is nothing but neurologically hardwired responses to particular data, because you got to be just scientific with it, right? You only find certain scenery to be beautiful because what evolution would tell us is that you had ancestors who knew that if you found beautiful scenery, you'd find good food, and that's why you think it's beautiful, because it'll attract that to you so you can get good food. That's the only conclusion. It's not beauty in itself. It's just there to get you along. It's there to prolong your species. But we know there is something else to what we see. Some silent message that is calling to us, and it is God's very glory being proclaimed without words to our restless, kind of homeless souls that are just kind of wandering this planet, right? It's a reality that is there that is speaking to us. Number four, the universal communicator. It says this, their message has gone out through all the earth and their words to the ends of the world. Here we find that God's communication has reached every single human being. Not a single person is exempt from this. Notice he says that it's in all the earth. Not most of the earth, not some of the earth, but all of the earth. This means that God's communication, there is no language barrier, culture is not a barrier, distance is not a barrier. This tells us that everyone intuitively knows that God does exist. You say, Chris, I don't believe God exists. Yes, you do. you just have just suppressed that thought. Okay? It is a reality that's written into your soul that no amount of logic or research or whatever else is going to be able to put that away. The fact of the matter is, deep in your soul, you know that God does exist. The problem is not the communication. The problem is the reception of that communication. We as humans tend to suppress this, right? This is what Paul wrote about in Romans 1. He said this, Romans 1:18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of people, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth, since what can be known about God is evident among them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, that is his eternal power, divine nature, his existence, have been clearly seen since the creation of the world, being understood through what he has made. As a result," people without excuse. Right? "As a result, people are without excuse." Romans 10:18, actually quoting from this very psalm we're looking at today, it says, "But I ask, did they not hear? Was there some excuse they could give?" Yes, they did hear it. Their voice has gone out throughout the whole earth, their words to the ends of the earth. What's he speaking about? Creation. It has spoken about the reality of God. No one can give an excuse. Now, I know I keep bringing him up, but I really like C.S. Lewis. And the Chronicles of Narnia series, I love the image of how he put this in the book called Prince Caspian. Part of that story, Lucy, if you're not familiar with the story, there's four kids of one family, and Lucy's the smallest one, she's the youngest, and they all get kind of brought into this world called Narnia. And Aslan is the lion that kind of would appear every now and then. And so part of that story, they're caught on a ravine. They can't get over. There's this huge ravine there. And Lucy looks out and she goes, "There he is," you know, and she sees him. He's on the other side of the ravine. And the other three kids are like looking and they're like, "We don't see Aslan. What are you talking about? He's not there." And they begin to mock her, make fun of her. "Oh, you're seeing things." And they turn around and go the other way. And she kind of just stops and she looks and she sees Aslan and she decides to go with her siblings, you know. Later on in the book, they find out, Aslan tells them, "You know, I was really there, you know, I was really there." And so they turn to Lucy and they said, "Lucy, why did we not see him and you did?" And I love her answer to this, really simple. She put it this way, "Because you just didn't want to see him. You just didn't want to see him. He's there. He's evident. You can see him. But the problem is you don't see him because you just don't want to see him." That's what Paul means by suppressing the truth. You just don't want to see him. That's why you don't see him. And that's the honest, sober truth for everyone walking this planet right now. If they don't see the reality of God in creation, it's because they just don't want to see him. This is, again, John Calvin called this the sensus divinitus, the sense of the divine is the Latin word there. It's the fact that he called about the universe is pregnant with God. It's an explosion of God's glory. It's God's second book. It's an awareness that God has planted in man's soul, right? It's deep down in the soul. I have three teenagers at home now, which sounds crazy to even say that, but I have three teenagers at home right now, and they all have cell phones. And about once a week, it seems like, someone loses their cell phone, right? You can't find it. And truth be known, usually it's Sarah that can't. So I actually have maybe a fourth. Can't find the cell phone. She's not here today, so I can say this. Don't tell her I said this, but she does. She loses her phone all the time. The kids can testify to this. But you know, there's this little app on your phone. We have the iPhones, you know, and you get an app called Find My iPhone. You go in, you can hit a button, ding, ding, you know, kind of set off an alarm on your phone so you can, and everyone's scurrying around the house trying to find where is it under the couch, you know, the seat, where is it at, looking for it. And that's kind of the idea. It's like we are that lost cell phone, and the creation is pushing the lost button, right? And it's just dinging. He's pushing the lost button. This reality is dinging inside of us that God does exist. And so we know we're not an accident, and that God is real. I love Fred Hoyle, a leading mathematician and astronomer from Cambridge, who's not a Christian, by the way, who did the thing you're not supposed to do in science. He went against the whole Big Bang Theory. And he actually wrote about this in front of the British Academy of Science, said the following. I love this quote. This is not a Christian, by the way. Just listen to what he says. "The probability of life arising by chance is the same probability as throwing a 6 on a dice 5 million consecutive times." Let's be honest. Let's be scientifically honest. We all know that the probability of life arising to greater and greater complexity and organization by chance through evolution is the same probability as having a tornado tear through a junkyard and form out the other end a Boeing 747 jetliner. I mean, he just did the math on it. I mean, that is the same math. That's why I said, if you don't see him, it's just because you don't want to see him. Because the reality is right in front of you. The reality is beating in your chest right now. The reality is flowing through your nostrils right now. God exists and God is real. Friends, if you're here today and you have turned a deaf ear to the communication of God, repent and open up your eyes and see. See what is right in front of you. Number five, lastly, the loving communicator. The last couple of verses talks about the Son. Here, he talks about, it's a very poetic way of describing. He talks about the Son pitched a tent. God has pitched a tent for the Son to camp in, right? So the Son's kind of like, it's like camping out at nighttime. I guess this is God's endorsement of camping. Okay, I confess, repent, you know, of my hatred of camping. I guess he endorsed it here. But each night, it's a beautiful image. Each night, the Son kind of says retreats into its night tent. And then emerges and comes out in the morning outside of its tent. And he talks about the joy of this, the joy of the Son. It's like a groom, a groom coming from his bridal chamber, not going into his bridal chamber, but coming out of it. I don't think I need to describe this in too much detail. Some of you may already get what I'm going at here. But have you ever seen, all right, you got a couple, they love Jesus, they fought really hard to stay pure, they get married, you know, they go to the wedding ceremony, the next morning, you ever seen them at breakfast the next morning, there's like this plastered smile, you know, like, we did it, you know, or something like that, you know? And they're kind of excited, you know, and it's like this newfound world, you know? They had sex, okay, let's put it that way. And in case you didn't know where I was getting at, you're never going to look at the Son again, because that's exactly what God said. The Son is like a groom coming out of his bridal chamber. They have the night he got married. He walks out, he's all happy, right? That is the picture. I'm just giving you what he has there, right? That's what it is. He's excited, okay? He's very happy. So the Son, he says, is a very happy, joyful, you know, is proclaiming that. Then he says he's like a runner, running strong, loving his running. That you can run, love running, by the way. There is this thing called runner's high that I think I've gotten one time in my life, but it does happen sometimes where you're like, whoa, this is really, really fun. It's supposed to be fun. I always tell myself that around mile 7 or 8. This is fun, right? This is fun. But this is what the Son is like, a runner, and is like a groom. I mean, he's really, really excited about proclaiming the reality of God. And so the point is the Son is enjoying telling us about God. It's like it's almost like a circuit preacher, right? traveling the sky every day from one end of the earth to the other, as it were, to tell us about Jesus. Hey, Jesus is impressive. Jesus is impressive. It's the Son's mantra. And at the same time, it's a blessing to us, right? It serves two purposes. It's proclaiming to us, and it's also blessing us, right, with warmth and light. It's God's love to us. And yet anyone who has lingered long at a sunset or stared into a cloudless night sky will acknowledge that there's still something missing, right? The universe, God's creation, as it were, it whets our appetite for God. And it serves to also whet an appetite that it can't fulfill, right? It awakens something in us like, man, there's something more here than just me. There's something more than this what is right in front of my face. There's a reality out there, and there's awakening that happens, but you don't know, where does this take me? What is it saying? This led Carl Sagan, not a believer, after decades of research and study and looking into the universe, he concluded this. It's nice to think that there's someone out there that can help us. Carl, visitor, person in this room, we don't have to wonder who the someone is. It does speak to a reality behind it, right? We don't have to wonder about the someone because God has a second book. We'll look at next week, but in detail, but today, a second book called the Bible. That's what we're looking at. And here's the thing. God, the great communicator, God, the great storyteller, didn't just give us more stories and information about himself in the Bible. Does this give us more stories and information? Does this tell us he's real, he exists, he exists, he exists? It does tell us that, but it tells us so much more. Because you know what it tells us God did? Here's the crazy part. And again, I know I beat the horse of C.S. Lewis to death, but I just love the way he put this. He said the reality is that God wrote himself into our story. He wrote himself in. He talked about in his book, Surprised by Joy, that God knew that man could no more know God than Hamlet could know his author and creator, Shakespeare. But Shakespeare, as the creator, could make it possible. Shakespeare could write himself into the play, and dialogue with Hamlet. And if you've ever read it, he actually did. He wrote himself in the story so he could talk to the character that he made, so he could interact with him. God did that with us. He didn't just write our story, tell us about our story, tell us about him in this kind of disconnect, as it were. He wrote himself into the story so that he, the Word, crazy, took on flesh and dwelt among us. He lived the life we couldn't live. He died the death we should have died to save us. And when he went to the cross and he died and the sun kind of went dark. Remember, it got all dark and the earth shook and everything. Creation went numb. Creation got scared, as it were. Creation was in sorrow. And yet when he died, that happened. When he rose again, what? The sun broke out. Proclaiming again that God is alive. And God came in and he died for your sin and rose again as the great communication of how we get this knowledge of God we see out in creation and this reality of us in separation. The chasm is bridged in the person and work of Jesus Christ, who is the Word, became flesh, dwelt among us and died and rose again, so that we can have that relationship with God, so we can communicate, as it were, face to face with our author or creator, God. That's the beauty of it. If you have never experienced that relationship, you don't know, you've never crossed that bridge, that chasm over the distance between you and the reality of God, Jesus is that bridge. He says, I am the way, what? The truth and the life. No man comes to the Father but through me. He is that. No other name given among heaven, Acts says, whereby we must be saved. He is the bridge. He is the chasm. He is the mediator, 1 Timothy 2:15 tells us. So if you don't know that, let us help point you to him. We're going to take communion, and we're going to give our offerings. This is what we do every Sunday at this point, have some silence. And we're going to think about the reality of God as our great communicator, okay? And how he communicates through his creation, and then also how he wrote himself in. And so we take communion, it's bread and there's juice, and they're there to remember, help us remember, physical ways for us to remember that God did, the Word did become flesh. The great communicator, the Word took on human flesh and lived, again, life we couldn't live, died a death which should have died to save us, and we take it to remember that fact, because that fact, that truth, is what moves us and motivates us. And actually, now when you come to know Christ, almost brings a whole new vision of the created world. You now see God all over the place. You've got new eyes. You're alive on the inside, and you can see in a whole new way God's created world. So as Christians, you're able to take and be part of this. After we reflect and have some quiet time, we give our offerings, take communion. If you're not a Christian, this is not for you, but we would love to talk to you, okay? There'll be people to pray with you, answer any questions you may have up front as well. Let's pray. Father, thank you for our time. Thank you for opportunity to reflect on your creation, the world that you have made. It is so beautiful. And God, as we have the opportunity during this time of year to be outside, Lord, may we take advantage of that. May we take advantage of things like we even created here, like a park that we can walk around, that we can enjoy and see the flowers, and the birds and the trees. And just contemplate and think about the reality of you behind all of it. God, help us to open our eyes and see that. Help us to get our eyes off of ourselves, as Piper said, stop looking at the mirror. And God, to look out at you and see your glory written all over the page of creation. We love you and thank you for our time. In Jesus' name, amen.